Good day, everyone. Welcome to the second inaugural Hump Day Infocast, Diagnosing and Care Planning. This is Michelle Gonsman, and if you listened in 2 weeks ago, we were discussing the starting process for the nursing process assessment, and today we're going to be speaking on diagnosing and care planning. To reiterate, I wanted to start with the nursing process because it is the basis for all nursing practice, and nursing practice drives the standard of care for nurses. And then we do talk about some physician stuff. And today, as I said, is going to be a very short. We're going to talk about the second and third steps in the nursing process. But to reiterate, assessing is the first step, diagnosing, planning, implementing, and evaluating. And all the while, nurses need to be using critical thinking. And you may be sitting there thinking, well, nursing diagnosis, I don't understand what a nursing diagnosis is. And actually, just very recently on a listserv for legal nurses, I was reading an attorney comment, and he was actually a physician assistant also. He had no idea what a nursing diagnosis was. I thought, well, wow, we really need to explain the difference, okay? And sometimes some of this stuff can be a little vague. You learn this in nursing school, but it is very important. So I'm going to try to give you a few quick examples so that you can understand. A nursing diagnosis differs from a medical diagnosis. A medical diagnosis refers to a disease process, colon cancer, all right, the process of this. It is made by a physician, and it will be a condition that only a doctor can treat. Nurses cannot treat colon cancer. It is not what we do. We can implement and carry out doctor's orders, like administer chemotherapy, but we can't treat that as nurses independently. In contrast, and this is where it gets a little philosophical here, a nursing diagnosis describes a client's physical, sociocultural, physiological, and spiritual response to an illness or potential health problem. And I'm going to give you hopefully a concrete example for that. A medical diagnosis, for as long as the disease is present, never changes. If you have colon cancer, you have colon cancer, you have colon cancer, okay? But a nursing diagnosis can evolve as the client's response changes. Now, this is what I mean by this. If a patient is diagnosed with colon cancer, and I don't like to use cancer as an example, it's such a horrid diagnosis, but I think this really can clearly demonstrate the difference. This patient may need a colostomy, okay, to treat their colon cancer. A nursing diagnosis, because we're treating the patient's response, I've seen patients all the time say you have to get a colostomy and they're just traumatized. So a nursing diagnosis might be alteration in body image. This is the response. The patient is worried about, what am I going to do with the colostomy? Is my husband still going to want to touch me? Does my husband still love me, or my wife? How am I going to deal with this bag now on my abdomen? So the nurses are dealing with the patient's response. They've assessed that the patient is upset about this and they say they have an alteration in body image. But as the patient deals with their new colostomy, and maybe this nursing diagnosis may be around for a while, but, you know, after a certain time period, the patient might be okay with this, and they don't have an alteration of body image anymore, so that nursing diagnosis will change. So hopefully that gives you like a little example. Medical diagnosis, colon cancer. Nursing diagnosis, how is the patient responding to this, and what can we do as nurses, give them resources, and how can we help them with their alteration of body image? There are formal nursing diagnoses, and there's a whole way to write them and a whole list of potential nursing diagnoses out there. And that's really not what I want to go into. So if I don't use it properly, if I have a nurse out there who does all nursing diagnoses very properly, I'm sorry if I'm not using the correct terminology. But what they do is they show that the nurse has assessed the patient. And a nursing diagnosis shows that nurse understands the assessment. It's fine to assess your patient. And please, as we discussed in the last InfoCast, please, we hope that nurses have assessed their patient properly and thoroughly. But you have to understand the assessment data and process it, which I call critical thinking. When nurses fail to think critically, that can be deemed as negligence. The risk for impaired skin integrity related to immobility and poor nutrition, as evidenced by high risk for pressure ulcers and eating less than 25% of meals. That's quite a mouthful. I'm going to break it down. Risk for impaired skin integrity. That is the assessment. The nurse has assessed the patient and they've maybe gotten a low Braden score. They see that grandma is immobile. She's had a stroke, or she's paralyzed, or something. So the assessment, and again, you're really going to understand this impaired skin integrity one in the upcoming pressure ulcer series. But so they've assessed. She now has a risk for impaired skin integrity, and it's related to her immobility and her poor nutrition. So the nurse assessed that she has poor nutrition and she can't move herself. And it's evidenced by her high risk for pressure ulcers and her eating less than 25% of meals. So the nurse has assessed the patient and thought critically and said, okay, we got to do something about this patient. It is, again, driven by the assessment. Physicians, they do it a little bit different when nursing diagnosing, and this is what we typically think of as when a diagnosis. So nursing diagnoses are not really well known. Everybody in nursing school dreads them, trust me. But physicians use a differential diagnosis. If a patient has chest pain, the differential diagnosis may include, among many, many more, is it cardiac? Is it pulmonary? Does the patient have lung cancer? Does the patient have a blood clot in their lung? Did the patient lift a little bit too much and pulled a muscle and now in their chest and now it hurts and all they need is some Motrin? So where is this differential diagnosis? And there, I know there's a gazillion other things it could be, but the physicians have to think, okay, it's not cardiac, they don't have a blood clot, and they sort of have to quote unquote rule things out. Now, when we do the electronic medical records series, which I promise I've been getting emails, it's coming, I promise you. But when we're doing that, it can be a little difficult for litigation depending on what side of the coin you're on. Because when chest pain appears in the medical record, there might be 100 differential diagnoses, including one diagnosis that one in a million people has, all right? So physicians with the EMR, they can be prompted to think if they've ruled everything out and they're like, oh, I just don't know what's wrong with this patient. EMRs can be very useful and say, oh, well, I didn't rule XYZ condition out and maybe I should. On the other hand, physicians have to say in the emergency room, for example, well, I can't rule out, 200 diseases because some of it takes weeks and weeks to roll out. So it can be, both sides of the coin here, but the differential diagnosis and ruling it out is how physicians diagnose. Most nursing diagnoses are point and click. And what I mean is they just click on a nursing diagnosis and that's it. However, when I'm reviewing a case, there are certain things that I would expect to see and as you would expect to see. For instance, if a patient has a Foley catheter, they have a catheter in to contain their urine, I would expect to see a nursing diagnosis dealing with that. For instance, alteration in urination or alteration in elimination, something to address that. Or for instance, if they've had a surgery, for a hip fracture, I would expect to see alteration in skin integrity and also potential for infection. So again, the nurse is taking that, they just had hip surgery and have this big incision and you know what, they have an open area and they could potentially be infected. So again, the assessment drives the diagnosis. So this fancy schmancy nursing diagnosis thing, okay, if they don't word it correctly, nobody's going to ding them for that or anything. But what it does is this diagnosis drives the care plan. And I think that's where we are in the medical legal world more familiar with the care plan. What did the nurses follow the care plan? All right. Some care plans are prefabbed ones. If you have a catheter, here's your alteration in urinary elimination care plan. You can actually even order generic care plans online. You really can. You can get on and companies provide them for you. But the important thing about the care plan, no matter how it's made or where you buy it from or if you handwrite it or whatever you're doing with it, the care plan is what drives the actual care given. And it is to be individualized. You can have a prefabbed one, but then you need to check certain things that you're going to do for that particular patient. I would say the most quote-unquote formal care plan you're ever going to see would be in a nursing home setting, because that is a completely different ballgame and there's very specific rules and regulations, and we'll talk very, very briefly about those. In a nursing home, it's not only prompted by the assessment, but some of the care plans are prompted by the MDS, the minimum data set, the thing that they report to the government that are usually 35, 40 pages long. So you're going to see more formal ones in nursing homes. They have to have a time frame. For instance, patient will not have impaired skin integrity by discharge. And most important, and this is where in litigation, there's fine lines, there can be some gray areas. And I would say sometimes there's just no black and white, but there are nursing orders. And again, it's like the nursing diagnosis. What are you talking about? For instance, a nursing order is something that a nurse can independently say, I'm going to do this. I've assessed my patient. I've diagnosed him with this, and I'm going to plan to do this. And it's independent of the physician. Nurses do not need a physician's order to do nursing orders. For example, if Nancy Nurse has assessed that her patient is at high risk for impaired skin integrity, the care plan might be for potential impairment in skin integrity. on that care plan, Nancy Nurse can make the check mark in the box that says turn at least every 2 hours. All right. We're not going to get into should it be 2 hours, 1 hour, four, three, two. We're not going to get into that right now. We will get into that in the pressure ulcer series. But right now, we're going to use the generic rule of thumb that most people are going by every 2 hours. She needs to do that. She has said, my patient is immobile. I need to offload the pressure. I need to relieve this pressure. I need to keep her skin clean and dry. I'm not going to let my patient lay there in a wet diaper. I need to keep her skin clean and dry because that's going to help prevent the pressure ulcers. She doesn't need a doctor's order to tell her that. Now, where the gray area might come in is facility protocols. For instance, use moisture barriers. All right. As long as it's not medicated, the nurse may be okay as long as the facility okays it with putting some type of moisture barrier on if the patient is incontinent. Now, if it's something medicated or has some medication in it, the physician actually either needs to order it or have a collaborative effort to have standing orders and protocols and things like that. So that's where the gray area comes in. Another gray area with nursing orders would be a nutrition consult. This can be under the care plan, but it would have to be a policy that usually is collaborated with a physician where they would say, okay, anybody with a Braden score of less than 15 automatically gets a nutrition consult. So nurses don't need to call a doctor once they've assessed the patient and assessed that risk, and they can go ahead and implement that nutrition consult. And if that is on the policy and procedure, the nurses have an independent duty to consult the nutrition. Or if a patient has a stage 3 ulcer, they must consult the wound care nurse according to their facility's policy. And again, we'll get into that more in detail. But nursing orders, again, are what they can do. And now let's go back to the turning every 2 hours. A physician can order that. So if the physician orders the nurses have to turn the patient every 2 hours, they have to turn the patient every 2 hours, unless, of course, it's contraindicated, then they have to let the doctor know why they can't or why they think they can't do it. All right. But just again, they don't need an order to change a dirty diaper, an adult brief. Okay. That is what keeping the skin clean and dry, offloading pressure. That is what a reasonable and prudent nurse in the same or similar circumstances would do. So again, going back to nursing orders, as long as it legally does not require a physician's order, like for medicine or something like that, a nursing order is something that a reasonable and prudent nurse in the same or similar circumstances would do. All right. A common intervention enlisted on nursing care plans is to follow the physician orders. All right. And that's such a generic statement. Follow the physician orders. All right. The physician orders are usually the plan of care for the physician. And the physician does have a plan of care. For instance, if you read a history and physical or a daily note, it should be under, you know, the history, the physical, or the assessment. Okay, the review of systems, then the physical exam. Then you're going to see the impression. What do they think's going on with this patient? And then they're going to see, it usually says plan. And that would be where the physician has the plan. So for instance, in a doctor's office, if a patient is on, I'm going to use the example of lisinopril, a blood pressure medication, you need to monitor their kidney functions every so often. So the plan might be to monitor the BUN and creatinine of a patient on this certain blood pressure medication. Now the physician has to follow their own plan. They actually have to go through and order that, because if they don't order it and if they fail to order it and the patient goes into kidney failure because of their blood pressure medication and their kidney functions, it's not going to be real good for the physician. However, we as nurses, and I say all providers, I don't know if you've been doing med mal for a while, I know for a fact that you all know, no matter what side of the coin you're on, there's a lack of a communication sometimes between physicians and nurses, and there's a lack of communication between physicians to physician, like a consultant. The cardiovascular guys don't know what the orthopedic girls are doing sometimes, and they don't read each other's plans or plans of care, and you have redundant stuff or contradiction in medication orders or something like that. So there's, trust me, after 22 years of nursing, there is a huge lack of communication between providers. And the medical record, the documentation in the medical record, is to allow for that better communication, so that I, as a nurse, if I missed talking to Dr. Smith because he came and did rounds and I was taking care of another patient, that I can look at his plan and say, oh, he's going to do this. He wants to do this. Oh, he's thinking about this. So it's sort of a duty that nurses read the physician's notes and vice versa. Physicians should be reading the nursing notes, and that consultants should read each other's notes, so everybody's on the same page. Does this happen? Not a lot. So for instance, if I read the plan of care for this patient and say, oh, you know, Dr. Smith wants to monitor Mrs. Jones' butin and creatinine, and I'm getting ready to send Mrs. Jones home, and I know that Dr. Smith wants to do this, but there's no prescription for the blood work, and it hasn't been faxed anywhere or emailed now, electronically sent is how they're doing things now. The nurse, knowing this, has an independent duty to say to the physician, hey, doctor, you know, did you want to monitor this now, or did you want to do this in 3 months, or what's going on? They have an independent duty because they know the plan for the physician to just ask the physician what they want to do. And a nurse should never, ever just blindly follow a physician's order. Okay, the nurse must follow good judgment and use critical thinking. We're going to have a whole nother Hump Day InfoCast on following physician's orders. I promise we're going to do that. But for example, if the physician ordered a blood pressure medication, and we'll use lisinopril again, okay? And the nurse gets a blood pressure. The patient says, I'm a little dizzy, I don't feel well, and the blood pressure is 75 over 42. And if you don't have your normal numbers, that's really, really low. Okay, the patient should be in bed, the doctor should be called immediately. That's pretty darn low. But if the nurse administers that and says, well, the doctor ordered it, he must want it given, well, that would be negligent because nurses must use critical thinking. Remember, back to assessing, they've assessed the blood pressure of 75 over 42. They're diagnosing, there's something going on here, alteration in cardiovascular status. I'm going to plan to call a doctor. What the nurse should do in that circumstance, and again, this is going to touching on another InfoCast, is just not give that medication at that point in time and immediately call the physician and say, hey, the blood pressure is 75 over 42. Mrs. Smith is really dizzy. Do you want me to give this medication, and what would you like done? So again, the nurses have to use critical thinking. They have to assess the patient. Nurses are with these patients 24/7. And as a little note, I actually heard a plaintiff's med mal attorney one time. I was at a conference and he said, I don't like to get the nursing notes because there's so many of them and, you know, it's just too expensive. Well, I'm here to tell you that the nurse's notes are where it is, believe me, because the nurses are with these patients 24/7. The doctor doesn't know that Mrs. Smith's blood pressure is 75 over 42 unless the nurse calls them. So it is a collaborative effort. When doctors order something, nurses have to make sure it's safe for the patient, etc. And again, this will all be discussed more in depth. What I love to say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. All right? If you fail, you're going to fail. For litigation purposes and stuff, there should always be care plans. And again, I already touched on this. In most settings, you're going to see the most formal ones, like nursing students would say, oh, that's a care plan I remember from nursing school, in a nursing home. But there are care plans in every care setting, and they have to be updated. They have to be reevaluated, and we'll talk about that in the next InfoCast, the reevaluation stage. I just want to... my last and parting thoughts are going to be about the regulations. There are regulations state by state. There are federal regulations. Just reiterating how important it is to plan your care, to diagnose and plan the care. For instance, Tennessee Code says that nurses must develop the plan of care/action based on a comprehensive assessment, desired outcomes, and current knowledge. Pennsylvania says that nurses must identify goals and plans for nursing care. Code of Federal Regulations for Nursing Homes. And if you do any nursing home litigation, 483.20 should sound very familiar to you, resident assessment. And I won't read the whole thing, but it says the facility must develop a comprehensive care plan. And it goes on to say, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says the comprehensive care plan must be periodically reviewed and revised by a team of qualified persons after each assessment. So it basically says you have to care plan, and it talks about the nursing process. So as you can see, we discussed most of the nursing process in the last InfoCast and this one. We've talked about assessment, and that one was pretty in-depth. We've talked about nursing diagnosing and a little bit of physician diagnosing and care planning and how important that is. Now, the next Hump Day InfoCast will be in 2 weeks. And by the way, I call them Hump Day InfoCast because if you don't know this, the first and third Wednesday of every month, traditionally known as Hump Day, is when I will be releasing the new one in the series, whichever series we're on. So again, the first and third Wednesday, that's why we call them Hump Day. So the Hump Day InfoCast will be in 2 weeks, and we will be discussing the last steps in the nursing process, which will be implementation and evaluation. If you missed the assessment one, because, you know, this is a new thing, and I apologize, you know, if you don't know that they're out there, or ever, if you say, oh, I missed that one on pressure ulcers, or I'd like to go back and hear that again, you can always go to our website, Gonsman Group LNC. It's G-O-N-S MAN. L as in Larry, N as in Nancy, C as in Charlie. So Gonsman Group, LNC.com. And it's under the Hump Day Infocast tab on there. I think it's on the lower left-hand side of my website. So please feel free to go back and refer to any of those. So I thank you for listening. Please also get in contact with us. My contact information's on the website if you have any questions. Or if you have a desire, if you say, hey, I'd really like to know more about XYZ topic and you want to hear that on a Hump Day Infocast, I'd be more than happy to do that. But I look forward to you tuning in 2 weeks for the implementation and evaluation and wrapping up of the nursing process series, and then we'll be moving on and on. So once again, I thank you and have a wonderful, wonderful day.